upon creation. Goodness and mercy, driven from the minds of the people. Lamentation, Josiah, deliver me, Josiah. Have mercy, Josiah. Father, send me some goodness and mercy. It took a murder, them a got charged for. A pure chemical industry, them a run from cultivation. Goodness and mercy, driven from the minds of the people. Lamentation, Josiah, deliver me, Josiah. Have mercy, Josiah. Father, send me some goodness and mercy. Send me some goodness. Send me some goodness and mercy. As far as the eye could see, but we are from the mountains of the moon. Kilimanjaro, oh, Kilimanjaro, oh, Kilimanjaro, oh, Mount Mansui, Mount Nebo, Kilimanjaro.
Welcome to another episode of Real Life the Radio Show, brought to you by Foundational Network. Foundational Network is brought to you by Black Talk Radio Network. If you enjoy any of the programs on this network, by all means, go to www.blacktalkradio.com. To blacktalkradionetwork.com and go donate to keep this this entity continuing on to pass this information that we come to find has helped other stations keep up their information. Brother Roz, how are you tonight? Today is Christmas Eve. Hope all of you are having a good warm day with the family. Brother Roz, yes. You there?
Greetings and good evening to everybody this evening. Yeah, I'm here. I'm still learning like you always are. We talked about that earlier today, and it's just really great to be able to have this discussion this evening. I know a lot of people are getting prepared. A lot of people in my family back in Trinidad are getting prepared for Christmas. And you know, for those who celebrate it, have a happy, healthy one. And you know, that's pretty much what I would say, but I just think tonight's discussion is going to be really good, because I think it's something that a discussion we just need to have. And you know, hopefully we'll get some other input and folks can give their thoughts and ideas and opinions, or if they have questions, ask whatever questions they may have, and we can get into a nice dialogue. I just think it's good. It's going to be a good discussion, and I think this is an auspicious evening to have that discussion.
I agree. I like to just throw this out there, because I know I had a hard time with it, still having a hard time with it, but this idea of Christmas.
Yes.
A lot of people have come to find out, and we've been hearing it a lot, about what's real and what's fake. Just mm-hmm. for those who are going through that phase of that withdrawal of Christmas, per se.
Yeah.
You know, make it easy on yourself and your children. Because just because you have found this information and are ready to implement it, remember your children are not. So be mindful of the mental terrorism that we could place on them and everything that's going on within their bubble that we're not privy to, while we're stripping them away from something that they have already grown to be used to. So just with everything in life, I think that always deserves a shout out, because I don't believe that we always think about those particular subjects when we are coming into the new information, per se.
Yeah, I think we can't wait to show all it. Children are different, and children are sensitive. So, you know, that you can't have a one-stop shop approach for all of your children. Each child is different. Some of your children might be ready for that, and you can just drop it on them, and they're fine. Other ones might be mentally scarred from that. You know, I've even heard stories of adults saying that, you know, when they found that out, the way it was put on them, it really like screwed up their trust in their parents. It just screwed up their belief in a lot of things. And it all depends on the psyche of the child. That's why I say anytime you have a relationship with your child, you have to cultivate that trust and let them or give them the knowledge by your behavior, your treatment, your reaction to when they make any missteps, that you are trustworthy, that you are the first person that they should be coming to if anything is going wrong in their life. And that comes from establishing a high level of trust and an extremely high level of communication. That was something that I learned from my wife, because in my family, the old school Caribbean way of raising your child was that children were seen and not heard. And if you did have something to say, you know, you can get physically handled early and easy, you know. And that was the life that I came up in. So I was not much of a communicator. Unless I was really, really going in on somebody, it was always aggressive communication, which translated really well into rap when I started doing that as a teenager. But also, I was very physically aggressive. You know, it didn't take me long. I wouldn't sit there and have no long argument with nobody before I would want to reach out and touch them. And a lot of that came from me getting an understanding, being out in the streets early, that that's how you handle things, quick and aggressive. And, you know, I just had to learn within a family structure, the importance of communication. I knew the importance of communication because as an MC, I was a word nut. I was just always reading things to learn new words and be able to use those words in rhymes. So that was not the problem. It was in the context of family. Like, I didn't really trust anyone. So, you know, she literally helped me just learn the process of, and there's an art to it. There is a fine art to family communication, and I learned that through my brilliant wife. And she really is the person who facilitated my growth into the best me I could be. I could not be anywhere near the person that I am without her. And you know, rest in power to my father-in-law. He was an extremely major influence on my life, and I miss him just intensely. But yeah, that's what I think is the most important thing, is that communication, that high level of trust, and that ability to garner communication that's honest and forthright with your child, and just giving them that feeling of safety and comfort that they have no problem opening up to you about anything. And that's the kind of relationship I think we should all be striving to have with our children. And that would make it easier to start teaching your children about the system of white supremacy at an earlier age. Because once you have that trust, then they'll listen to anything you say. And if you tell it to them in the right context, you just wrote that on BTR Community earlier, you can say anything you want if you know how to say it. And if you know how to teach your child, you can inform them without putting them in a state of fear. And I think that when I look at you, Jenna, just as my example, I see children that are highly aware of the system and how it functions, but they're not fearful at all. They think like little adults to me about the way they approach their lives and the influence they have on other young Black children, as far as being able to convey the wisdom that you bestowed upon them to other people's children, to the point that their parents want to know who their parents are. They're like, well, if you're learning this from them, well, who's their parents? You know, like, they learning this from they? Let me find out. I need to meet them. And I think that that's a beautiful thing, because I think they're a prime example of a young children that are being molded to really understand the world that they live in and how this world will react and potentially treat them at some phase in their life.
You know, we are just doing the best we can. You know, because for everyone that's done right, we make so many mistakes with the others. But
very true.
Yes, let's continue on though. Let's pass them up. Now, what you wanted to get into tonight, because we discussed so many things.
The first thing is actually health related, because we into flu season already, and I just want to stress the importance of things like colloidal silver, oil of oregano, four thieves oil, And really colloidal silver, because the cold and flu does not stand up to colloidal silver at all. And colloidal silver kills germs, funguses, viruses, bacteria. It's antimicrobial, antifungal, anti-mold, mildew, all of that stuff. And it actually smothers the cell. And the way that it smothers the cell, because it is an actual physical action that's taking place, the cell cannot mutate past silver's ability to kill it. Whereas when you deal with antibiotics, it's more genetic based. So if you have a disease that's mutated into a form in which that antibiotic is no longer effective, then basically you have a superbug, and then you have more people being affected by it and effectively potentially killed by it. So with silver, that is an impossibility because of how it attacks the cell. It smothers the cell and chokes it to death. It cannot breathe, and it dies from that in that form and fashion, the way that nanoparticle silver functions in the human body and in all living things for that matter. So I think this is really for people who are into taking the flu vaccine, and it's really done from a really good scientific position on why it's dangerous actually to get the flu vaccine. So it's you see it there. It's on healthtube.com. It's on YouTube, and it started at like 45 seconds and then stop it at like 8 minutes, 10 seconds, because he's really explaining stuff that I think is important for everyone to hear.
Right.
And okay, so that's the first one.
That show that when you get an annual influenza vaccine, you are actually more susceptible to a pandemic strain. here's what happens. And let me explain that in a little more depth. There's something called heterosubtypic immunity. Now, when you have a healthy immune system and you go out into society, and by the way, vitamin D has been shown in many studies that it is protective against complications from influenza. It is protective against pneumonia, and is protective. It's protective against all sorts of different diseases, respiratory diseases especially, and boosts the immune system. Now, how do you get vitamin D? You get it by going out into the sun. You produce vitamin D on your skin. You can also get it through supplementation. And when do we get influenza? When do people get the flu? When are they more susceptible? In the winter, in the dark months, when they don't have as much sun and they're not getting exposed to sun and their vitamin D storages in their body are low. And they've done studies. In fact, I summarize. There's a chapter in here on vitamin D, okay? And the chapter on vitamin D shows that that it will protect you against various types of influenza. And most people around the world are very low in their vitamin D storages. So now, if you have high vitamin D in your body, you're eating right, you're taking care of yourself. When you go out into society, you're going to be exposed to influenza, but you won't catch you won't get symptoms. Okay, but you do get something else. You get heterosubtypic immunity. So you're exposed to influenza, whatever the strain is circulating in society. Now, what is this heterosubtypic immunity that I'm speaking of? Well, what it does is it offers you cross protection against future strains. So that here's what happens. Every year, influenza is circulating in society. There's two or three different strains. The following year, it mutated a little bit. There's something called antigenic shift, and it shifted. So it's a little bit of a different strain. Following year, same thing happens, slight shift. This goes on for 10, 15, maybe 20, 25 years, and then there's a pandemic strain. A pandemic strain is a strain that has taken a large jump from the previous strains. So it's a large antigenic shift. So there's not much immunity in humanity. That's why it strikes so many people and can be more dangerous. We don't have immunity or protection against it. However, when you are exposed each year, this is Mother Nature's way of offering you cross protection or heterosubtypic immunity to future strains. And what the studies have shown time and again, and these are studies in animals, and these are studies in humans. They show that when you get an annual influenza vaccine, you are more than twice as likely to end up in the hospital fighting for your life when a pandemic strain comes along. When the strain that you really have to be worried about finally arrives, those people that received an annual influenza vaccine are the ones that are going to be fighting for their lives in the hospital. The people that are not getting the annual influenza vaccines are the people that are developing the heterosubtypic immunity. Those people do not end up in the hospital. Those people are more protected. They have, if they do get the disease, if they do catch influenza during a pandemic year, they simply move through it because they have protection that Mother Nature gave them through this cross protection from having been exposed to previous strains of influenza. When you get that vaccine, you are prevented from gaining the heterosubtypic immunity. And so that's important information. And I summarize at least four or five different studies in this book that show that's what's going on. Now that's not even discussing the other studies. I've got studies in my books that show that the flu vaccine is not very effective. Thomas Jefferson, I'm not talking about our past president, but Dr. Thomas Jefferson works for the Cochrane Collaboration. He's an independent scientist. And he has done a meta-analysis is a study of all the previous studies. So he looked at the 75 previous studies that were done around the world on influenza vaccine efficacy. And then he, in his meta-analysis, that comes up with the combined results. And what he found was there's no efficacy. And in some of these influenza vaccines, there's no evidence in the studies that the influenza vaccine is even effective, that it's even working. There's other studies that show that you can increase vaccination rates in the elderly so that you can go from, they looked at 33 seasons, influenza seasons, because they're told that the elderly are most at risk from influenza. And they've looked at, there's one of these studies, they looked at 33 previous influenza seasons. And they showed in some of these seasons, only 15% of the adult population, the senior population, the elderly, was vaccinated. And then they go through and show where in some years, where four times that, over 60% of the population was vaccinated. No correlation between death rates. There's no, you can increase the vaccination rates in the elderly four times over, and it will not improve the death rates in the elderly. So there's a lot of studies that show that the influenza vaccine is keeping us from having protection when we need it the most, and showing that the vaccine can't even confirm that it's protective. And there's also studies showing that I hear from nurses a lot that they're being told that they can't keep their jobs anymore if they don't get an influenza vaccine. And why? They're being told not to protect themselves, but because they need to do it to protect their patients. That
interesting. Ross,
yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand the science behind why people discuss that the influenza vaccine is not only does it not work, but it's also dangerous. And I think that this kind of outlines that he kind of makes the science of it plain in regards to, I like the way he explained it as far as the subtopic immunity and the fact that just encountering that illness, you build up antibodies that are able to adjust to the genetic twist that the disease goes through, even if it takes a pandemic shift, which is a huge genetic leap in mutation. So I know the average person doesn't understand that aspect of it. And I think to hear it outlined by a person who wrote a scientific text, you know, dealing with this and properly reading statistics in which you had, you know, different samples. And sometimes he actually had summaries of multiple experiments that were done. And he would actually have summaries of like clusters of different tests and different things that were done to try and determine the efficacy of the flu vaccine. And it's not effective. Sadly, my mother believes a lot of what she's told by the doctor because she comes from a very small island in the very nearest part to the equator in the Caribbean. And the hospital system was horrible there. And we've had many family members that went to the doctor, you know, they were told they had a flu, and in less than a week later, they were dead. And then come to find out they were misdiagnosed with the flu. It was something tropical that does happen, but it's very rare. And they never actually tested for that. So they sent her home for antibiotics thinking she had the flu. And then a week later, my great aunt was dead. So, I mean, like, and that's just one of many different stories like that. So she's always, you know, thinking that the U.S. has the best healthcare system, and she worked for the state of New York, so they had a really good health, you know, health plan and things, but she doesn't really understand it on that level. So she takes the flu shot because she gets bronchitis now. She has asthma. And so she feels that that's the best way for her to combat it. And, you know, me and her don't really talk to each other directly. We haven't for many years. But my son's in contact with her, and, you know, sometimes I try to give little gems to her through him. But I would have a bigger effect on her because I always have in the past. I'm actually the child that she would listen to about a lot of those things, and I would actually be able to get her to do certain things. And because we don't really deal with each other, you know, to minimize conflict, that aspect of our relationship is no longer functional. So my son doesn't have the same effect on her that I do. So that's it. But I just think it's very important because we're coming into those winter months. You know, a lot of people are going to be asked about it. They were giving out free shots about a month ago on my job. I told them, nope, I don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just what it is. And they're not going to force me to do it either.
Right.
You know, it's just, go ahead.
Yeah, it was a few things that was kind of questionable to me about what he was saying at the end.
Uh-huh.
But we done discussed a lot of that. We done discussed a lot of that, what he was, all the information that he was bringing up. One of the things I want to ask you is he kept referencing the vitamin D. Can you give us a little more insight on why we should take more vitamin D and what it actually does for our bodies?
Absolutely. Vitamin D, the vitamin D he's talking about is not just vitamin D. It's actually vitamin D3 specifically. And vitamin D3 is the type of vitamin D that the body creates from the sun when the skin is in contact with the sun. It's the same vitamin D that reptiles create when I have turtles. So I have an area where they can come out and rest. And in that area, I have a UVA lamp and a UVB lamp. And the UVB lamp is what facilitates the production of vitamin D or D3. If those turtles don't get access to those lights, they actually will, their shells will start to warp, their bones will get brittle, because D3, that's one of the main foundations of strengthening the bones. It's not actually calcium, it's magnesium you need to strengthen the bones, and vitamin D3 is really great for that too. But ultimately...
Hey, hold on, Rob.
Yes.
We got a caller. Before I take this caller, callers, whenever you're calling in, I don't have it set up the way it can be muted as soon as you come in. So I mute you. That's not to get rid of anybody. That's just to keep the quality of the show going so we don't hear any of your background. So this time I'm going to go ahead and not mute them. Caller, what's your name, where you calling from, and what's your question or comment? Welcome to Real Life. Caller? Out of Virginia? I see your mic moving, but we can't hear you.
Oh, he's muted himself. Maybe he's
all right. All right, go ahead, Ross.
Are you talking to me?
Yes,
oh,
sir.
Yes.
Hey, man, this is Otis. What's up?
Oh, greetings,
Otis. Greetings. Peace and love to you, brother OG. It's great to talk to you.
Look, Merry Christmas. I actually was just dialing in on a computer, but I'll throw it in since I'm on air. Okay. I want to commend you, gentlemen. I heard your opening talk, and you were talking about communication. And
yes.
I don't want to disrupt the flow of your program, but I'm going to tell you, gentlemen, I really applaud the way you actually work on that verbal communication. I heard you talking about it earlier. It's a deliberate discipline when you teach your children that. I heard Roz talking earlier. I actually started reading early, and my mom and my parents, they stopped getting Christmas gifts from me at 9 because I had that conversation with them about Santa not being real. Mm-hmm. So I was only 1 out of 5 that did that. And the only thing I had to do was not disrupt it for my sisters and brothers. So, you know, I really liked your opening dialogue, but I was on the phone listening.
I appreciate you.
Yeah. Look, much love and peace. I'm going to try to listen in and not interfere. Keep getting going with what you're talking about.
Anytime you have something you want to chime in with, we greatly appreciate it. Do not, you know, that's what we're here for. We want to hear what you have to say. It just adds to the different dimensions of the dialogue, and differences in perceptions can really be something that helps other people, myself included, in expanding on understanding something we're talking about. So please chime in if you have anything you want to say about any part of the discussion, or if you have a question as well.
The only other thing I was going to say, I always leave here with a better understanding of life and stuff. You were talking about the immunization. I've never taken any shots once I left the military. I had a choice while I was active duty. But when you explained about the immunization and those flu shots, I've got friends that have been hospitalized and many strokes and everything because they've been taking that mess. And I didn't understand all the technical parts of it. But innately, I just knew, I thought it was degrading my immune system by taking that stuff. And I don't mess with it either. So I'll mute myself and you gentlemen get on with the program.
Oh, man. Thank you very much, Brother Otis. And I feel you. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, 100%.
Being in the Navy, standing in that line, taking them shots, that alone would change your perspective. Like you said, after you get out, you wouldn't take it no more. I understand. But go ahead, Roz.
No problem. So, so with vitamin D, the importance of vitamin D is it is extremely important for the optimal functioning of your nervous system. It is a great part of the maintenance of the strength of your bones and teeth, the development and growth of healthy skin and hair. It is also probably the most important vitamin to facilitate immune system health. It is, like, to me, the foundational vitamin in regards to maintaining a healthy immune system. Like you said, it naturally helps with respiratory issues and protects the body from damage from respiratory illnesses. Like I said, it's also very, very important for a healthy nervous system that you have vitamin D3 in your system. Of course, it works closely with melanin because it's produced in the melanin layer of the epidermis, the outer layer of the skin. So it's even important to the maintenance of healthy melanin as well. And
while you on that pause, if you like to for you that's listening, if you like to go look at the PDF or what have you of this book, it's called Critical Vaccine Studies. So you can go put that in Google and check out and look at some of those case studies that he's talking about if you like.
Yeah, so what you find is people who do not have access to vitamin D, and I talked about this on a previous program when we played the Black Doctor discussing vitamin D3 and how he was so severely deficient. He was in the double digits. And he was talking about Black people, especially in northern reaches of the United States, should take at least 5,000 IUs or international units per day in order to maintain a healthy balance of vitamin D3 in your system. You can never overdose on it. So even if you take too much, your body will just naturally flush it out. Bottom line is that in order for you to maintain not getting colds, flus, and other debilitating illnesses, being better able to fight infections when you come in contact with them, being better able to bounce back from illnesses when you get sick and bounce back quicker, D3 is that thing that you want to have in your system circulating at the highest levels possible, especially as Black people, because we're actually physically designed to be in the equatorial regions of the planet Earth with our dark skin. And that is to filter out the excess UV rays. Our melanin actually does that. It's the only living molecule that's able to absorb up to 1200 degrees of heat and remain unchanged as a molecule. It is also the only molecule that's able to take sound and light energy into itself and change them into one another at will. Basically, it's considered the God particle, because even when you have the sperm and egg meet in the womb of a mother, it is melanin that facilitates the growth and development of the different body parts and organs of the microscopic organism that becomes a zygote and an embryo and eventually a human being. The parts of the brain that are heavily melanated are the parts that are most important to not just mental health and memory and things like that, but also spiritual development. You know what I'm saying? And these are all the heavily melanated parts of the brain, the subanigra, the locus coeruleus, the pineal gland, the pituitary gland, all of these places. And one of the most heavily melanated areas in the body are the human male, black male genitals. So yeah, it's really, really something, vitamin D3. It's something that's, I think, one of the most important vitamins that you can take on a daily basis to maintain basic health, just across the board, from immunity to nervous system health, and especially with immunity, because the diseases that are coming out now and the way that they're developing these diseases, there are many more superbugs because we're inundated with antibiotics in the meat products if you eat meat. And then on top of that, they give out antibiotics very heavily for other illnesses. Or if you go to the dentist and they see that you have an infection, colloidal silver can kill an infection in your mouth and prevent you from having to get a root canal. I had a personal friend of mine that went to Florida this summer that was suffering from a horrific toothache, and I gave him a bottle of colloidal silver about 2 weeks before he left. He told me, first of all, within hours of him receiving the silver, he was able to like swish it around in the area of the tooth, and it was hurting him real bad, and his gum was starting to swell. And he said literally the pain went away within a couple of hours, and he was using it for the whole 2 weeks. And he had told me that he had healed so much, and he had gotten very low on the bottle the day he was flying out to Florida. He was relocating, and he said he was terrified for that bottle to finish because he was afraid that the infection would come back and he would go back into that excruciating pain. So I actually had to send him a link on Amazon where he could get more of it. And I was telling him about the machine, but he just took the information regarding the silver, and he was able to get more. But it was just crazy because he said he had never experienced anything like that. He said usually he just has to suffer like crazy until he would get to a dentist. I said, nah, I said, this stuff works for a lot of things. And I sent him more information about it, and he was like, wow. And he thanked me. Sometimes we talk about that and you kind of laugh about it now. But yeah, there's a lot of things you can do with it. And a lot of uses for it. Yeah. I would say for those who want to know more about the different uses of colloidal silver and the medical benefits, the different diseases it cures, the different cancers that it's known to cure, that's documented, there's a website called The Silver Edge. It's www.thefilvictoredge.com. And that site, go to the section that says articles. And it has the most up-to-date comprehensive information on colloidal silver and the different illnesses that it cures, whether it's from scientists who have actually done different tests and experiments dealing with people or things like that, or actual first-hand accounts of people who are suffering from different illnesses use colloidal silver and it actually, facilitated healing where they were pretty much cured. I remember reading MS patients that were like, it's almost like I don't have it anymore. And they found that MS, the underlying facilitator of MS, is an infection. Silver kills that infection. They found that rheumatoid arthritis is facilitated by an infection in the joint. Silver kills that infection. They just found out that Alzheimer's is actually caused by a virus. I just read this like a few days ago, that they're now starting to classify it as a virus because they're finding out that that's what it is. Silver kills the virus. So,
Yeah, plus what you practicing at home with your information is always the key with your family.
Absolutely.
You implementing all of this stuff and seeing it in real time. So that's another thing, too.
Absolutely.
Boy, that Silver Age, we know you love that.
Memphis, they just have a lot of great information, I think, and because it's up to date so that you can find stuff that might have just come out yesterday. Like they put out articles on a regular basis pretty much every week, and it's all new information. When they had the cervical cancer, the woman that was cured of cervical cancer, the other one with that head and neck cancer, they had somebody who was cured with leukemia, and they have studies done on that. It was just tons. There's so much information there dealing with toothaches, root canals, skin diseases that were incurable, where they had like canker sore like diseases that wouldn't heal for years and years. I had an aunt in Trinidad that had an issue like that, and I wish I knew about silver then, but I was a child because she got bitten by a dog and she had a wound that just wouldn't heal, and it would just get worse every so often, get a little bit better but never really heal. Wounds like that silver was curing for people, curing people's dogs of cancer, like crazy stuff. So I mean, it's all on the site and it's all documented. So yeah. That's why I always recommend that site, because it's really, really, goes into the science of that stuff. Go ahead.
That cream cleans stuff up too. That silver cream is.
Yeah, the 10,000 parts per million cream.
Yeah,
they got that on Amazon too. And that stuff, man, that stuff from ringworm to, you know, shingles. Like silver actually kills shingles too. I wish I knew about shingles when my father-in-law was alive, because he used to suffer from that. He didn't suffer from it often, but when he did, he would get it real bad. And man, he would really suffer on his arms and stuff. He would get, you know, those kind of chicken pox-like marks, and silver would have got rid of that in no time, and also quell that incessant irritation and itching and stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of things I wish, a lot of people whose lives I could have changed years ago if I knew about silver years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, hindsight's 20/20. All you can do is do the best for the people you come in contact with from, you know, whenever you know forward.
I agree. Now, it seems we have a caller, Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome to Real Life the Radio. What's your name? What's your question or comment?
Hi, this is Tia. I just have a cell phone with a different number. How are you this evening?
Good evening.
I'm still learning.
Thank you so much. This is always a good conversation. You talked about a lot of good things. The field of communication is important. I was talking to my mother because I don't have kids. And we were talking about Christmas and all that. And I was like, well, if I have kids, I'm not going to tell them. She's like, oh, they should be kids. I'm like, they can still learn how to ride bikes and all that. Other stuff that kids do, I don't know what. None of my family of course is going to stop them from being a kid. I didn't know that. So I was like, okay. I said, well, I guess that's why I don't have kids. I'm being punished. And my mother, you know, being her, she goes, oh, okay. No, that's not true. Not, I was like, okay. I'm like, no Easter Bunny, no Tooth Fairy. Because like I said, especially having black children, all the stuff you have to go through, no need to start with real lies. There's too many other bad things that they'll find out and don't know how to deal with, and they think stuff is true that it's not. Then they don't trust you and they'll come to you if they have real problems and stuff. And if they have real problems, and then you can't help them because you set them up with these things that are not true. And then about the health stuff, I'm glad you talk about that. That's so important. And again, just using my mother, I had told her about milk thistle for the liver, and she kind of, whatever. But then it was on Dr. Oz or something, so then it was the greatest thing. I said, okay, whatever, as long as you get the information, whatever. And she still takes it. She took it for years because she was diagnosed with hepatitis C.
Okay.
And so I was like, take that. And she took it for years. It wasn't like this shot or whatever they give you that you take six shots, whatever, and you're cured. That costs like $40,000. It's expensive, but it's supposed to work. But she took it for years and years and years. And then one day, maybe a couple years ago, she had called. She was like, she went to the doctor and they told her they couldn't find it anymore. I was like, and it's not like my mother was eating healthy. She drank water, but she was still eating cake, cookies, and ice cream. She went, you know, she didn't make a health change in her life, but she drank water, and she still takes it. That milk, this was faithfully, and as far as they know, you know, they keep checking, but they don't see it anymore. So,
wow.
And she get it from this place online, Puritan, I'm not to promote them, but Puritan's Pride, that's where we go to get our vitamins and stuff, so they're usually low cost, and that's what she takes. She's very faithful with it, because she has to take other and she takes other medications for other things, so the other medications, not eating properly, she eats regular food, ice cream, like I said, all that, but faithful with the milk thistle, and they said they couldn't find it, so I can just go by what she told me.
And it's funny, because while you were talking, I just happened to look into hepatitis B and how, if you know, silver works on it, and they actually have an article on the Silver Edge that came up, and it's basically entitled Silver Nanoparticles Inhibit Hepatitis B Virus Replication. And they just go into it. They say in this study published in the journal Antiviral Therapy in 2008, researchers from the Department of Medicine, University of Hong Kong, demonstrated that the silver nanoparticles could be used to inhibit the replication of hepatitis B virus due to the ability to bind with the viral DNA. According to the study authors, quote, silver nanoparticles have been shown to exhibit promising cytoprotective activities towards HIV-infected T cells. However, the effects of these nanoparticles towards other kinds of viruses remain largely unexplored. The aim of the present study was to investigate the effects of silver nanoparticles on hepatitis B virus, HBV. And the in vitro and anti-HBV activities of these particles were determined using the HepAD38 cell line as the infection model. And an absorption titration assay showed that the nanoparticles have good binding affinity for the HBV DNA. We found that AG10NS could directly interact with the HBV viral particles as revealed by transmission electronic microscopy. The study authors concluded silver nanoparticles could inhibit the in vitro production of HBV RNA and extracellular virions. We hypothesized that the direct interaction between these nanoparticles and HBV, double-stranded DNA, or viral particles is responsible for their antiviral mechanism. So it inhibits the replication at the level of the DNA of the hepatitis B virus. So, yeah, something else mom could add to her regimen.
Yeah, and, I guess hopefully they show her on Dr. Oz, because I can say it was like, ooh. But now I know you all your life. It's like one time she went to the doctor, like she has her started going regularly, and they gave her pills for high blood pressure. I'm like, mommy, you don't have high blood pressure. You have a lot of things. And, you know, she looked like I'm crazy. I go, mommy, I know. I've seen you actually in the hospital with problems. You have other things. You don't have that. And then she was taking it. She had to stop because her pressure went too low. I go, see, I told you. You
wow. Did you go with her to the doctor?
Huh?
Do you go with her to the doctor sometimes?
Oh, we live in a different state. So I can only
Okay. But it's good she has you, because I was going to say, if ever she gets sick, don't ever let her go to the doctor or the hospital by herself. Always have somebody who is healthy and in their right mind that can ask the right questions. So if they try to tell her to do something or give her some injection or some medication, that person can ask questions. Why are you planning to give that to her? What does it do? You know, because a lot of times they'll actually give them certain things on purpose and they'll experiment on you against your will. You won't know that they're doing it. And if you don't have someone speaking up for you, you're sick. The only thing you're thinking of is wanting to feel better. So if they tell you, take this shot, you're not going to ask what it is. Give it to me, doctor. You're just hoping that you feel better when they give it to you. And it could be something totally different or something that's another infection for all you know. You know,
I agree with that. And also, because that happened to me, I got sick and no one was there. So what I did, I had my phone. So I called her and had her listen while the doctor was talking to me. So, like, you hear what was said, and then he was like, well, why didn't you ask about that? I was like, okay, because like you said, Eve, you could be a genius or whatever. When you get sick, all of that goes out the window.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's when you're right for something to happen to you. And then you also have to remember that in the hospital, most people get incurable infections in the hospital. Some of the most deadly, uncategorized infections lurk in hospitals. Because the environment is not really pristine. You know, they use like low ultraviolet lights in there to try and kill germs. They you know, mop and do all that stuff. But really, they don't have a mechanism for getting rid of superbugs. So there's a lot of superbugs that lay dormant right in hospitals. I used to work for a hospital system in New Jersey. And I used to just get stories of just the craziest things. And people would go there healthy, go to visit a relative and catch something that was incurable while they were in the hospital visiting their relative, you know?
Yeah, also you talked, not to keep going, but you talked about the, I'm sorry, you played the video or audio about the nurse, nurses having to take the flu. Now, I know that happened to this lady. When I lived in Ohio, she was a nurse, and she was telling me that. She was telling us that, too. I think it was about time for her to retire, so I think she went on out and retired. But they were trying to force her to take the flu shot. But she, even though she was a nurse, you know, she knew about the oils and the colloidal silver and things like that. And so she was like, I'm not taking all these shots. You're not going to give me all these shots. And I, and she had a young, she had a son that was disabled that she had to take care of. So, you know, she had to be healthy, not just at work, but definitely at home. Because, you know, you can walk and stuff like that. She was like, I'm not taking no shots and things like that. But, yeah, the oils and the vitamins and, in fact, the lady, she, I'll never forget, she had this stuff. It was called Panaway. I don't know where she got it. Panaway. You put that on wherever it hurt. Like, less than 5 minutes, the pain went away. I mean, you still should go to the doctor if you see something broken with an x-ray or all that stuff. But, like, simple things, like I had an earache real bad, and they had it, when we were in service, they put it on my ear, boom, things go away. So there are a lot of natural things that, you know, that you can't ignore. So just be mindful of those things. You know, I'm not saying you got to be an all hippie. It's not about being a hippie and crazy.
No, it's about avoiding those drugs.
It's about your health, you know. They don't want to give you quote-unquote health care, and we already know if you listen to the cows about the medical apartheid, so they can have the best health care in the world. That doesn't necessarily mean we can get it. We know, if you remember Serena Williams, when she had her baby, and they didn't want to believe her, and she a rich black woman, so it don't have nothing to do with money with us. You know, she was black, and they didn't want to hear her. She's like, you know, I had these conditions, which to me was strange, because her conditions were documented in regular newspapers. I knew she had them, and I'm not a doctor. I read them. You know, she talked about the clots and stuff. And when she had her baby, she was like, you know, she almost died because of the clots, and they weren't, you know, they were kind of slow to listen to her. So.
That is a major issue, us being believed. Go ahead. You were going to say something, Jenna?
No, I was just saying thank you, and, I was just wanting to ask, I see you down in Memphis.
No, I don't live there anymore.
Okay.
I was down there for school. I'm actually visiting my family in South Carolina. I live in Georgia. That's usually where I call from.
I was wondering if you knew about the land bank.
No, I don't know about the land bank. I went there to go to school.
Okay, well.
I just know about my land where I live in South Carolina with our family. We have that. They have the land where it's all owned by everybody. I don't know what they call it. But where it's all owned by everybody. You can't just up and sell it. Like, that's how they got the Hilton Head people.
That's. Are you a part of the Gullah community?
My family, I just said, yeah, that's what.
Yeah, because that's what you're talking about. Yeah. Actually, we got into that earlier this summer. We had a whole video we played on the Gullah Geechee people, and they were talking about the loss of their land due to, you know, people, some of the people, you know, selling out their portion of the land, forcing everyone else to do the same thing because of the way the law was written. And, you know, they've lost a lot of land. And, of course, along with the land is going to go these traditions that they've held on to for hundreds of years, you know, since their ancestors were kidnapped and brought here. So it's wild. It's really something else.
But
so
I think the thing online, because no one showed it to me, I found it. But yeah, like, because my father's name, my aunt's, and one aunt passed away, so I guess it goes to her. But I've been very clear. I'm going to come here when I retire. So.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
It's beautiful weather. You can plan everything.
That's great.
That's beautiful.
I wish you the best, too. That's wonderful.
I had, I'm going to go just get this out anyway.
Sure.
Thank you. That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
The land bank.
Greatly appreciate your input. Go ahead.
The land bank of Shelby County. It's a website where you can go. And you can buy property that's around you. If you're in Memphis, Tennessee, or you know somebody out in Memphis, Tennessee, it's nothing that, you know, get flashed around, but it's something that all of us need to know. And if it's a land bank somewhere close to you. So I would just want to pass that along. We can continue on. Did you have something else about the video you wanted to get into before we move on to the next one?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to reiterate that you need to take a minimum of 5,000 IUs or international units per day to maintain your a healthy amount of vitamin D3. And it's something I would be taking all year round, simply because we don't have enough time in the sun in the summertime to really benefit from that. We would need more months out of the year with intense sun in order to really benefit from it on a really, really big level. So you're basically always vitamin D deficient. That is why Black women tend to get the most aggressive forms of cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, and breast cancer. And it's also the reason that Black males get more aggressive forms of prostate cancer and colon cancer is because of a lack of vitamin D3. A lot of doctors don't tend to tell them that. And as a result, when they get these diseases, because vitamin D3 is a big part of your immune system, fighting diseases and even preventing cancer, that they're already in a lose-lose situation. And then they start the chemotherapy and they're going to be given the platinum-based chemotherapy, which brings a living organism close to death, hoping to kill the bad cells while it's also killing good cells. And then, you know, that just throws them even further into you know, disarray as far as the balance of their body as a living organism. So, you know, that vitamin D3 is foundational in preventing and protecting from so many different cancers and stuff that, you know, it's like, I can't stress enough how important it is. I hope the guy in the video did the same. Because it really, really is like a foundational vitamin as far as protecting your life and your ability to live as healthily and as long as possible. So it's something I just can't stress enough. And with colloidal silver, like I said, the longer I've been using it and making it, the more important it's become in my family's life. And we've seen it work on my father-in-law before he passed away. But he had miraculous healing of bed sores at 88 years old before we lost him, and a myriad of other different things and sicknesses my family's encountered that we've used it for successfully. Jenna as well. I've been around for quite a few of those things that it helped him and his family with. And, you know, I've recommended it and given it to other people that I know, and it's helped them with illnesses, some of them very serious. So it's something that I've seen firsthand. It's not just something I'm saying, check this article out, but the articles are great because they're scientific. And if not that, they're firsthand accounts of people who suffer from illnesses that cured them or got great relief using colloidal silver. So, mm-hmm. You know, those two things I can't stress enough. And it's just, you know, and nothing kills everything. Sometimes you need to use different things in combination. It all depends on the illness and you know, what you're trying to do to facilitate healing and what type of illness it is and all of those things. So, you know, nothing is a cure-all, but I would say it's the go-to thing. And if you study the history of the use of colloidal silver, it was the only thing you were prescribed whenever you went into the doctor with an infection, illness, virus, or whatever the case may be. It was the only thing that you were prescribed by your doctor up until the early 1900s. And when they started to develop in the Western Hemisphere, the antibiotic, they needed to make money off of it. And that's why they started to basically outlaw using silver. And they had a campaign against letting the public know about the use of silver. That's something we experienced with my father-in-law when the wound care specialist came to our house. And I can tell you that story another day. But basically, you know, that's when the campaign against silver happened, was because ultimately silver kills the problem at the source and makes you better.
It's a
the
cure.
The healthcare system is designed to keep you sick and take away the symptoms. So you're always sick and they're always giving you a quote-unquote temporary cure for the symptoms. Then they give you a strong drug. The drug has side effects, and they have to give you more drugs to counteract the side effects of the first drug. And that's how it goes. It's just a whole cycle of bad health perpetuated until you croak. And that's it. You know, so it's a lot to it. But once you start to study, you read books like Medical Apartheid, Killing the Black Body. You can go into the medical experimentation on Black people, which is detailed very well in Medical Apartheid, where people go to the hospital for a certain sickness and they literally give them something else unbeknownst to them. And they're experimenting on them. The stories in that book are just incredible, but they're true. And they still happen to this day with Black children, too. There's all kinds of horrific experiments that were done on Black children and Black males, hey, irradiating boss. Black male testicles and all kinds of wild stuff. Go ahead. What you were going to say?
Nah, we just got to get into this. Take a song out the break.
All right, you. Thank you for being with us this evening. Take your leave on Real Life, the radio show on Black Talk Radio Network. We are Foundational Radio Network. We are going to get into this conversation, but for now, if you wish to call in and make a comment or ask a question, please call in at 704-802-5056. Again, that's 704-802-5056, and press ** if you wish to ask a question or make a comment. And we'll be right back after this commercial break. Peace and love.
My fault. I had to go do something real quick.
Oh, it's all good.
Now, that was great. That was great. You answered my question to the T, and I'm glad OG and the sister, everybody added on to that question about that D3. So appreciate that. Which one?
Yeah, I love talking about it. The next one I wanted to get into is, I think we should probably go with Queen Diambi first.
That's what I was thinking. So let me get that together, and we will try to shoot right on through these.
All right, perfect.
Understand something right now. This is powerful. We got the Queen of Congo in the building right here. Sister Queen of Four, come on over here, please, sister. I would like for you to introduce to us, to our audience, who we have here.
You have royalty. You have African royalty. We have in our midst African royalty all the way from the Congo. We are charged and fortified this evening, healing and bringing our people together who have been colonialized. Well, this is an auspicious moment because this is our king queen of the Congo. And the last time that we are in our history, Hatshepsut was the king queen, and that's the only king queen that we are aware of in our studies. But this is our king queen of the Congo, and our people need to know about her work and why she's here, and the mission and the unification of us from the homeland of the mother to here. So you have a message for our people. And so we want to welcome you in, and please give your full name and the meaning of your name officially. We're sisters. We bonded. We met 4 days ago. And so we have been connected ever since. So I love you, I appreciate you, and I support you, and we're on the same mission to liberate our people. So please share with us.
Thank you, Queen Mother. Thank you very much, Queen Mother. And although we have been together on this plane only for 4 days, we've been together for always.
Lifetime.
Yes, my name is Queen Diambi. but my name in my language would be Diambi Mukalenga Mukajiwanka Shama Wabena Chiamba Nebakwa Mpungu Nebakwa Luntu. I am queen of the Bakwa Luntu people of the Kasai region, and my kingdom, the Dimbelenge kingdom of the Luntu people, used to belong to the Luba, the great Luba Empire. And I'm indeed a female king, because Mukalenga Mukaji means female king. I'm also Mukalenga Mukaji Wankashama, means I'm female king of the order of the leopards. So I belong to the most ancient school, mystery school of Africa. Our Congo people, the Konkoi, because Congo is really Konkoi, the tamer of leopards, used to be the one initiating the pharaohs of Egypt, who were also initiated into the school of the school of philosophy of the leopard society.
How long have you been in existence?
I have been, the Luba Empire has been in existence since the 15th century. Of course, we are spread all across Africa, especially southern Africa. We are from the central region of Congo all the way to Zambia. We are also in Tanzania. We are also in Angola. We are also in Namibia and all the way to down to South Africa. The Zulu are Luba. The Zulu people are also Luba. They were part of the Luba Empire. So as Mother, Queen Mother Afua, who is really my elder and my guide, who has guided me all the way back to her so she can support this work that we are doing together and support my spiritual growth and development. My mission has really been to work with the diaspora, work with our children of extracontinental Africa, as I call you. You are Africa. You are just extracontinental Africa, because everywhere you've been deported to, you made a life for yourself despite all the difficulties that you had to go through, and you made this land Africa. So every land where the African are is Africa to me, and my job is really to come to you to give you half of your story. Because once you were deported from the land, you had to struggle and find your way to your own stability here and to bring forth your liberation, and the fight is still on. And you missed out on the story that was happening to the rest of your family who stayed on the continent. And for many, many years, we were apart. For many, many centuries, we were apart. And they did it purposely so that you think you can never reunite with us, because we were holding some of your story. And the same way to us, when our children were taken away from Africa and deported and brought here to this land, and to all the lands in the Caribbeans and so forth, half of our story was stolen from us, because we never knew what happened to you. We never knew where were you and what happened to you. And it's only fairly recently that we are reuniting with this story. So as we hold half of your story, you hold half of our story. So we need to get back together, and we need to unify, and we need to reorganize so that we can reconsolidate our identity with all the aspects of our identity, not just the experience that you have lived here, but that experience belongs to Africa, just as much as the experience we live on the continent belongs to you. You need to know what happened there, because what happened there wasn't fun. What happened there wasn't us running around with Tarzan in the jungle, just happy to be and not worrying about what happened to our children. What happened to us was that we were brutally destroyed because our family were taken away, and whatever was left of us, we were only few left, and where we were enslaved in our own land. So you have to know half of that's your story, to know what happened to your relatives who stayed on the continent. So that is the information that you need, so we can be back on the same, around the same table, so we can get stronger, because we have hard work to do still ahead of us. So thank you.
Can you talk to us about the condition of the mindset between our African brothers on the continent and us over here? Because it's like this hatred that this white man set up, and he's making it look like y'all don't love us over there, and they're making us look like we don't love y'all over there. So can you talk about that? What happened to us on that?
Well, this is still feeding into the spirit of division, and the spirit of division is what makes us weak. And of course, our weakness is somebody else's strength. So when I grew up in Africa, they used to tell us that, you know, the Americans were the evolved Africans because they were evolved and we were the savage ones. They were evolved because they were most like the white people. They were more like westernized than we were. And they didn't like us and we were savage to them and they would look down upon us. And also the image that we saw on TV was very negative. Most African American that we saw. They were, you know, criminals and drug dealers and gangsters or prostitutes when it came for women image. Or you had to be really a high-level athlete or high-level entertainer, and then you were okay. But the great majority of the Africans here were not, you know, doing well. So they were teaching us not to try to identify with them. So they made it seem to us like it was very dangerous for us to come here and we will never be loved, nor will be welcomed by our brothers here because they were evolved and we were not. The other thing is that if you don't know your history, in Africa, they didn't teach about the period of enslavement of our people. They forbade us from speaking about it. They would kill people from speaking about that history. So we were not allowed for hundreds of years to speak about what was happening and to teach what was happening. So I didn't even know that the Africans that were here actually came from Africa. Many still believe that the Africans who are here are indigenous to this land because they think, well, every land has black people and white people. I guess those lands have black people, but they're not from Africa. So we have a lot of myth going on that kept the separation alive, but today it's over. Today, it's the day of reckoning. So today is the day where we say no more. Today is the day where I come to you as a ruler in Africa and come to look for my children here because all of you have Congo blood. No matter what the DNA plates say, all of you are African because remember, Africans, we didn't have Congo, we didn't have Ghana, we didn't have Nigeria, we didn't have South Africa, we didn't have any of that. All our land was Kama, and all of you came from Kama. All of you came from one land. We didn't have borders, we didn't have frontiers, we didn't have passports where you needed a visa to go see your brothers from another area of Africa. You could freely circulate all throughout the continent, and you could freely circulate your goods and your services all throughout the continent. And we did so. That's why you can find Luba people all the way down to South Africa because it was one Africa. We could move freely all over the continent. And all these things that they teach us about wars between us and all the tribalism and all that, this is really a very fairly new phenomenon in Africa. This is a phenomenon that's only a few hundred years old. It's not a phenomenon that's indigenous to African understanding of how to live with each other. So we are the peace people. We are the people who know about, you know, compassion and love and peace and how to live, to make community thrive and also to make community thrive in the way we do not destroy nature, our mother, who is the earth. So we are here to really bond and connect with all the aspects of the African development because you are just an expression of Africa. And you have gained in wisdom, in understanding, in knowledge, and we need you around the table to birth this new Africa that we want to birth. And it's not just for the benefit of Africa. We come with the knowledge, the know-how, the wisdom, the technology to save the planet and to make sure that humans go back in the center of what existence was meant to be.
Let me ask you this. In dealing with the religion, have Christianity made its way to the Congo? And I'm talking about the European Messiah, the European Christ. Is that over there, or do y'all still practice your traditions, your African customs, and your African spirituality?
Christianity came to Africa with the Europeans that came to Africa first in the 15th century. So we've had the influence of Christianity ever since, and of course that before that of Islam ever before that even eighth century. We have the Islam really influencing Africa, and Congo just like a lot of other African countries nowadays we are heavily influenced by Christianity. and of course Muslim. And sometimes it's even a reason for us to fight among each other. So it's yet again another reason for us to be divided using philosophies that are originally in some ways inspired by African greatness and African philosophy at the core. However, but that was definitely changed and altered to fit the needs of others, other cultures. Unfortunately, people who want to try practice tradition in Africa are very, very much stigmatized. They disrespected and stigmatized in many ways. However, we are still there. The people who have respect for the elders, for the tradition of our forefathers, for our cultures, we are still very much there. So although we are still being repressed, there is a force that is stronger, and there's a lot of young people, especially young people. In the Congo, there is a movement of hundreds of thousands of young people who are reclaiming the ancestral heritage in their spiritual practice. In Africa, we do not have what the concept of a religion per se. We do not have religion. The way we live is our religion. The way we behave, the way we respect each other, the way we respect the community, the way we respect nature and what nature provides for us is our so-called religion. Don't forget we are using foreign languages to express ourselves. So those concepts are really not concepts that comes from our own mind and own spirit. Those are foreign inherited concepts. So here we are talking about religion. Religion is about uniting people, religar. But we didn't have to unite people because we were always united from the get-go. So other people that needed uniting maybe used those concepts that they borrowed from Africa, they altered in their own need, not so much to unite the people, but to dominate people. So here we are now, and it's our responsibility as the elders of the human community to reclaim our strength and to reclaim our space as the elder of the human community so that we can now teach ourselves first, so we can grow and gain knowledge of who we are, so we can really do the job we are sent to be to do on this planet.
I have a question. How did you become a king queen? Yes. Today, our king queen of the Congo came to visit us, the Global Sacred Women Village in Brooklyn, New York, and blessed all the sisters. And there were two things that she shared with us. One is how she came into her formation. This is it's from the bloodline. I'd like for her to share that because it's an extraordinary moment right now.
Well, yes, my great-grandfather, King Chiyomwata, is my direct link to kingship. But my father, when he came turned for my father to take the throne, my father refused it because for my father, it was the traditional stuff, the old folk stuff. It wasn't very important. We had to move forward and be as westernized as we could be. So he was not interested in that because he already had been enthroned and crowned by all the Western titles of doctor this and doctor that and great lawyer this and great ambassador this. So all those titles were basically better than the traditional crown that his people was giving him. But because the royal the crown had to sit on one of his lineage, then the elders investigated and chose me. But while they chose me, I wasn't aware of that. And how I became aware of that is thanks to people like Professor Small and people like Yeyefini Efumbolade, who were my elders here, who were the one who held this knowledge precious.
Now you see what this comes from.
They held this knowledge precious. People like Dr. Jeffries, people like Queen Afua, who from lineage of our ancestor who were deported and came here to be put in forced labor camp and to be exploited, still held tight to this tradition, to this philosophy, that one day and pass it on from one hand to the next hand to the peril of their life, because many of them lost their life because they held on to these rituals and these traditions and this wisdom and these sciences. And thank you to these elders from all the way from Cuba, coming back to Florida, Miami. I was then taken care of by my elders here on this land to prepare me for me to go back to the Congo and claim that throne of King Queen Diambi or female King Diambi. So this is why I say to you in there, you have to wake up because Africa needs you. to help Africa stand back on her feet, because we have been even more destroyed. Because we have gone to a lot of brutal events, extermination. Congo suffered a 12 million people extermination. And that's after enslavement of our people. So about 4 million, it's estimated that about between 4 and 5 million were already taken during enslavement. So when they and then another 12 million was exterminated on the ground. So this is really important for you to know, that without the work of my elders here in the United States, and the ones from the Caribbean, from Cuba, from Panama, from all these elders that came on this side holding that wisdom in their heart and passing it on, I would not be sitting right here in front of you saying that I'm king queen of the Congo, of the Bakwaluntu people. So this is why you have to listen to your elders here, and you have not to have any complex as to, oh, it's not African enough. You are the best representation of what African United looks like, because in you, you have everything. You have all the tribes of Africa in one individual. All our ancestors got together to create Africa United in you. So Wakanda is no further. Wakanda is you. Thank you. Here's to my elder, my Dr. Jack.
They know us better than we know us. They know our potential, our power better than we know our potential and our power. So they want to keep that from us. If you take an elephant out of Africa and you put the elephant in an American zoo, two elephants, male and female, they have offspring. The offspring is still called an African elephant. It doesn't become an American elephant. It doesn't become a New York elephant. It won't become a Cali elephant. It's still an African elephant. You take an Indian elephant and you throw the Indian elephant in Africa, it's still an Indian elephant. So I was sitting there and I was thinking about this anti-African propaganda that's being pushed by a lot of brothers and sisters claiming that they're not African. And I stumbled upon the answer. And I'm not even a conspiracy theorist type of guy. Like, I deal with just the facts. That's all I do is just the facts. That's all I'm here for. Nothing else. So if you have a conspiracy theory, bring me some facts and then we can assess it. Anything beyond that, it's like, nah. So I'm sitting there. Why? Why is there all this anti-African propaganda? I decided to go back a little. Sometimes you ever heard the phrase, you need to go into your past to understand your future. So I went back to Libya. I went back to Gaddafi. Didn't actually go to Gaddafi. Can't speak to him. But in essence, I kind of did. I went back and I thought, Gaddafi had this plan to unite Africa, all of Africa, with a united Central African banking system, which meant Africa was going to get out of debt within 5 years. And then, allegedly, within 10 years, Africa was going to be in its rightful position at the top of the world, globally, global position financially. Why would that even be possible? Because you had an entire continent of 54 countries and then some, because outside of Africa, being in a position where they were all going to deal with the African gold dinar and all use one currency and say, we're not going to use the euro, we're not going to use the dollar, we're not going to use the pound. All of a sudden, this man who was quoted by the UN and NATO as being an exemplary ally was all of a sudden seen as a tyrant, a traitor. And all of a sudden, there's all of this propaganda and he's all of these bad things and they had to go in there and kill him. But when you realize that the powers that be could not have this man in the position that he was at, because what he was evoking was this African unity, this pride, which meant everybody within Africa was going to excel. So now you've looked at Libya and seen how much of a threat an African man was. Now you go a little bit further. Let's look at South Africa. South Africa are moving leaps and bounds economically because of their movement and their stance that they have taken against their colonizers, against their settlers, their invaders, and said, look, we're taking the land off you. We're not going to allow you to cheat us anymore or steal our land. And we're going to put black people in the position they're supposed to be at. Cyril Ramaphosa himself has stated that he is wary of doing trade deals outside of Africa now. He doesn't want to do trade deals with people outside of Africa. He's wary of it. something clicked in my head and I was like, bingo. All of these anti-African movements that are coming, we're not African, we're this, that. We're American, we're this. I truly believe that all of these Aboriginal, Indigenous, any anti-African people that are now using this bullshit propaganda are government agents. Because the United States government does not want Black people to leave America. And if Black people leave America to go to Africa, Africa is going on a social economic rise. And the American government know this. They see this. If the government can get enough Black people to believe that they are not African, then Black people in the Americas, so we're talking the Caribbean, South America, and North America, feel that they have no connections to Africa, then they will remain in America, and America will still have a strong position. But if Africa rises, keeps rising, and all of a sudden, Black Americans, Black Jamaicans, Black Colombians, Black Brazilians, Black Puerto Ricans, Black Dominicans, people of the African diaspora go, yes, Africa is the destination. So they leave. They leave the Americas. All Black people, all people of African descent leave the Americas and they go to Africa. Who do you think is going to suffer? Let that go into your mind and understand now the agenda, the ulterior motive with all of this talk. We're not African, we're this, we're this, we're that, we're that, we're that. So that you don't have a connection to Africa. Because once you don't have a connection to Africa, you can't be an ally to Africa. They feel you going to Africa. Let's say hypothetically, now, I don't want anybody to feel offended by this. I know that there are people that have the skill and the know-how in Africa, but I'm using an example. Let's say Black Americans, and when I say Black Americans, I'm saying all of the Americas, South and North, for this particular example. Let's say Black Americans are the skill set, and let's say Africans are the resources. Africans are the resources, and Black North and South Americans are the skill set. Africa has all of the resources you need. They have everything you need, all of the equipment, all of the tools, everything you need. Then you have people within the Americas that may have further education, may have further knowledge, may have further abilities. And if you will put those together, what do you get? So you have the builder scenario. Let's say I am a builder, but I have no tools. I have no materials, no bricks, no mortar, no cement. And let's say you have the tools, you have the resources, you have the equipment, the materials, but you don't have the skill set, you don't have the knowledge or the know-how. So together, if we come as a unit, we can build a house because I have the knowledge, I have the skill set, and you have all the equipment and all the material that I need. Together, we build a house. However, on your own with just the equipment and you don't know how to do it, you can't build a house. And if I have the skill set, but I have no equipment, no material, I can't build a house. So the United States government knows this. So therefore, if you keep African-Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, Afro-Latinos distant and away from Africans, they can't build a house together. So you look at these brothers that get large views, crazy views, millions and millions of views, saying that they're not African. And this is kind of unheard of. Really? This is kind of unheard of. In the small time frame, that doesn't happen on Black YouTube. That does not happen on Black YouTube. And then all of the pieces start to fit together. Tell Black people that they're not African. Tell them that they're American or they're indigenous to this land. And we'll push it. We'll push the views. Millions of, yes, millions of views. You can check it for yourself. Millions of views. You've never seen that kind of thing before, have you? Not with a topic like this, right? Because they push it. They promote it. So cherry picking little pieces of information, manipulating your mind. Because the reality is this. This is all part and parcel of the European's plan. The European fears that you will jump ship because they need you. Your spending power is crazy. You know this, right? Majority of Brazil's population is African. See the agenda. See these agents. Take little pieces of information, manipulation, cherry-picking information to fit your narrative and hope that some people are blind and hope that some people don't pay attention because you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you ain't gonna fool everybody. I've had people tell me that I'm an agent because I'm pushing the African narrative. And I thought, really? So you think that pushing the narrative that Africans are incredible, or pushing the narrative that we are African and that life and all of these things started in Africa, language started in Africa, all of the resources we have, all the power in Africa, you really think that's what white people want? Nah. White supremacy is about the belief system that Europeanism is perfection, that white people are superior. So how can a man of African descent who dismisses any rape blood within his veins, pushing the knowledge and the teaching that Africa and Africans and black people are truly at the top, they just have to recognize their power, how would that fit into the narrative of white supremacy? Because it's a simple oxymoron. White supremacy pushing Africa is an oxymoron. That doesn't make any sense. So I've been called an agent. I thought to myself, now I've been called many things in my life, many things. An agent is not one of them. And I thought, a snitch will always try to pass on the blame to somebody else and say, I'm not the snitch, you the snitch. A liar will always tell somebody that's telling the truth, say that that truth teller is a liar. A spy will say they are not the spy and say that the person who's telling the truth is the spy. Africa. I mentioned Gaddafi. I'm now mentioning Cyril Ramaphosa. Many scholars talked about Africa finally gaining its rightful position in the world. And the very people that want to stop that will be the white man, will be the Europeans. And you got a lot of black people outside of Africa. So your best thing to do is make them believe that they ain't got no connection to Africa, nothing to do with Africa. Once you make them believe that, once you get them to do that, you maintain that disconnect. And that's why the government want black people to deny they're African. The slave masters, when they gave the enslaved people their so-called freedom, they told you you're not African. They said Africans don't like you. The Spanish government, the conquistadors, the Portuguese, have told the black Hispanics, the mulatto Hispanics, the black and mulatto Latinos, that they're not the same. You're not the same. You're not African. And now you have a continuation now where it's black people saying they're not African. So it's pretty obvious what's going on here. So I ask you to open your mind and let all the pieces fit. What benefit can black people disassociating from Africa truly have for black people, firstly? Secondly, what benefit can black people disassociating from Africa truly have for the white man? That's when it starts to make sense, right? When you start saying, wait, what benefit does it really have for black people? And it doesn't really have any benefit. I've told you in many videos before that many Europeans and many Asians are trying to take over Africa. They're trying to move into Africa because they see what Africa has and they see the power that Africa has. They see the resources that Africa has. These Europeans have been telling you, oh, Africa's shit. Don't go to Africa. It's all mud huts and bushes and sand and shit. Don't go there. There's nothing for you. They tell you, oh, Africans hate you. Africans hate you. They don't even like you. They sold you. They sold you. All the while they say this, Asians are in Africa making a killing. Europeans have been colonizing Africa for so long and trying to make money from Africa, pushing this division. They give you a negative stereotype of Africans, all while at the same time they push a negative stereotype of black Americans to Africans. Slavery never stopped. During slavery, when they decided to cause division between the tribes, they told the African tribes, oh, guess what? This one hates you. This one dislikes you. Then they went and told the other one the same thing. Oh, they hate you. They dislike you. Then they turned around and said, we'll give you some guns if you give us some people. Then they went to the other side to keep them fighting, to keep them divided. They started dividing Africa, putting borders, changing names, creating so-called countries, which is what they did. And once they did that, a divided people becomes a weak people. So that division meant the white man was able to colonize. And where colonization and politics could not complete the Europeans' plan, religion came in handy. I've said this before, religion is the strong arm of politics. Religion causes division. Why does religion cause division? Because people will put their religion before their own people. And if you think that this is bullshit, think about it. Think of Islam, think of Christianity. People would die for their religion before they die for their people. So where politics and colonialism couldn't do it, religion came in to say, don't worry, I got you. Now, I'm not saying religion is bad, because it may help some of you, but understanding how religion can be used. So all they did for centuries is divide Africa. And now, as they saw these conscious movements and these Pan-Africanist movements, look what happened. There's people saying, oh, they want you to go to Africa. They want you to go to Africa because, no, they don't. Marcus Garvey had a Back to Africa movement. And what did they do? They sabotaged the boats. They tell you, go back to Africa. Go back to where you came from. But they ain't never going to let you go back. They'll never let you go back. And that is why they got these people pushing. We was already here. We was already here with their cherry-picked information. I want you to quote me on it. There is going to
Okay, I wanted to just go ahead on and play those two. I want to play those two real quick now. You're listening to Real Life, the radio show. If you have a question or comment, by all means, give us a call. That number is 704-802-5056. Press ** to open your mic, and we'll get to you as soon as possible. The reason I wanted to play that one right behind it, because she spoke about something that we done spoke about several times the last couple of years, is that the Africans also didn't know what was going on. Yeah. So I'd like to hear what you, I'm going to let you go ahead on and dive into that.
All right. It ties into that discussion we had November 27th when I discussed Black people in the Americas taking advantage of starting up businesses on the continent. And if they don't want to physically relocate there, you don't have to. You know, you would have to make a certain number of trips a year to make sure things are running smoothly and to have those important meetings that you can't do, you know, via Skype or something. But ultimately, there are ways of doing it. And out of all of the different economies on the planet, the African economy is wide open. It's the only place on earth where you can, you know, in less than 5 years, have a $1 million company. And it's something that's happened to a lot of people. It's just, you know, you have to know what you're doing, make the right connections on the ground, you know, understand the customs and the culture, depending on where you're choosing to set up that business, and a whole bunch of other things. But ultimately, if you do it right, you can really, really, you know, really make money at a rapid pace and have a business that would take decades, that would normally take decades to thrive in the United States, you know, and in a lot of other places in the world. So ultimately, what I was looking at was the fact that, you know, she said, hey, we didn't know what happened to you all. It was like you were here one day, going the next. We were being dominated by white people, and they did not allow us to talk about it. And it reminded me of Dr. Errol Robinson when he talked about the fact that the plantation owners here had called this guy, I think he might have been from England or somewhere over there in Western Europe. And he had come over there and he said, you know, he was looking, they were having problems with the slaves rebelling. And they were saying, do these people know who they are? That they have the Songhai people and that, you know, they had these revolts in Africa and they had these revolts over here. And they answered them, yes. He said, then that's your problem. You know, he said, when a woman gives birth to a child here, you separate them immediately and you send the child to a faraway plantation and you work the mother to death. So there is no continuity of the of what actually happened to them. There is no connection to Africa. There is no connection to the fact that their people were actually fighting, you know, incredibly hard to try and prevent what happened. And she basically said the same thing in the Congo. So it's not something that's foreign to or you know, only happening in one part of the continent. It's happening all over the place, because in order to dominate people, you have to have them forget who they are, and you have to have them forget any connection to people who would be considered rebellious, because at that point, it's just going to foster more rebellion. So she said that. She talked about that. She talked about the fact that after a while, they believe that Black people in America were just indigenous to America. They just had this lofty view of the fact that, yeah, they're indigenous to over there, because, you know, everywhere in the world, you got Black people and you got white people. That's what she said. And I'm like, wow, it's so funny how when you are suppressed to the point where you have no control over the 10 areas, actually 11 areas of people activity anymore over your life, and it gets to the point where it's intergenerational memory loss that happens, then you actually fill in the gaps for yourself, even though you don't know that you're filling in the gaps with a falsehood. And she talked about that. And this is something that I think is very important. On the flip side, I'm going to bring up an incident that happened, I think, 2 summers ago on the West Coast. And Gus talked about it on the Cows, where there was a Somali man in, I think it was in Washington State or Oregon, who was basically lynched. And the Somali people in the area did not create any hoopla or protest. But the American Africans from that area, like, they, the news came out, they were protesting in the street about what was happening to him because he was lynched. And it was a racist event that took place. And the Somali people in the neighborhood did not know the history of American Africans and the history of lynching here. So they had no idea there was a racial connotation behind what happened to their friend and family member. They just thought he died like a random death and it was not good. But they had no concept of racism as it's practiced in this country. And I said that was a learning moment, teaching moment, where the American Africans could have taught the Somali people about that so that the Somali people could better codify around understanding the system of white supremacy here so that they function as a collective unit and connect with the American Africans to fight that in their area. From what I understand, that didn't happen. The Somali people were very thankful that the American Africans protested on their behalf. They did get a better understanding, but I don't, from what I know, I could be incorrect. I don't think anyone made inroads at trying to create a system of education, cultural education, so that these people could coalesce around solving the problem. So these are the types of things that we can do instead of taking an adversarial stance to people who are coming from other parts of the world. Let them know how they might be taking benefits that were meant for you that are really sorely needed by your people. As immigrants coming into the country, maybe they can help mitigate those things if you work with them. But if they don't understand and you just going off on them and turning against them and they just people trying to do the best they can. You know, I know when my mother came here, she got negative information about American Africans. You know, that was just the way it was. I was just lucky that I had a father who was able to better understand things here and got connected with the revolutionary circuit in New York City. If it wasn't for that, then they might have had that same thought, ideology, and understanding about things and would have passed that on to me instead of, you know, literally helping me to understand that if it wasn't for the struggle fought by my cousins up here, I would be coming here on a slave ship and not by plane as far as my parents' arrival here. You know what I'm saying? I would have been born on a plantation. So I was taught to respect and honor that and understand that I'm in somebody else's house and I'm a visitor in somebody else's house and I have to respect their house.
Yeah.
So, you know, go ahead. What you gonna say?
Nah, it spins in all different ways. It creates so many different thought processes when you get the understanding what happened as far as not just to you but to your people across the road. Well,
absolutely.
Not to use a metaphor, but there you go. That's starting to wear on me too. I'm trying hard not to do that.
Understandable. We all still learning, so that comes with the territory, you know. And I always tell people in America, the overwhelming majority of slaves that ended up, or enslaved Africans that ended up in the Northern Hemisphere, what we call North America, were slaves that came from the Caribbean. There were very, very few ships that came directly from Africa straight to North America. So really, y'all are transplanted Caribbean Africans for the most part. Even when you read the book All God's Children by Fox Butterfield, that goes into the life of Willie Bosket, which was the first person tried as an adult and sentenced as an adult at the age of 15 in the United States. When they trace his family back to South Carolina and they connect the fact that a great majority of slaves in that area were transplants from Barbados. So you have a lot of Bajan culture in South Carolina. When you talk about the accents, some of the Southern accents, their variants, American African variants of Caribbeanized accents, because these people were transplants from the islands. That's why when my relatives moved down south from up here, they feel even more at home down south because they feel like they're back home. Depending on what state they move in, the weather's similar to home. You know, up here we get way more storms than we get in Trinidad. But I mean, you know, a lot of the different cultural mannerisms and norms and stuff like that, when you get with the old school culture, is very similar. So they feel more at home down south in some cases. And then a lot of people feel at home up here in New York too. But it all depends on you know, your mind and your adjustment patterns and all of that stuff. But ultimately, it's just understanding these things and respecting these things and having a code around these things. When you look at what the brother Angel was talking about in regards to the reasons why they don't, America as a country does not want us to make those connections with Africa. And it's true, they need you here. Who are they going to abuse in jail at massive rates to make billions and trillions of free dollars off of if you pick up and leave? And I'm not saying that people should pick up and leave. You know, you have a stake in the struggle here. But like I said, there's ways of making business connections there, having highly prosperous businesses, and even other Africans talk about, hey, set up your business in Africa. You know, you're employing local Africans in Africa, but take the money back to where you live in the States and use that money to help yourself and our brothers and sisters where you live.
Yo.
And they don't see that. And they don't see that as a drain on their economy. They see it as a cross-cultural sharing. You're employing people. You're coming from America, starting a business and employing people locally. You're taking the extra profits you make back to America to do the things that you would like to do to assist and help and facilitate justice for your people where you live. What's wrong with that? I mean, like, really? You know, it's the best of both worlds. Now you have Kagame from Rwanda. Paul Kagame is working now to make it so that the whole continent is visa free, where you can travel to any country the way it used to be. And she's not lying. It used to be that way. A good friend of mine, who's an African historian and linguist, Osar Imhotep, he has a brilliant essay called The African Superhighway of Wisdom. And he's discussing the fact that on the continent, wisdom was such an important motivator for people's lives that some people would actually go throughout the continent getting initiated by different ethnic groups. They might start out in the Horn of Africa and literally by foot walk all the way down through different aspects, different countries, and get initiated along the way. Sometimes spending 5 years in one place or X number of years in another and get initiated into multiple spiritual and medicinal systems throughout the continent, and then take that information once they make their journey, their circuit, go back home. Some of them choose to set up shop in one of the places that they travel to. But this is something that used to happen regularly, and he documents it excellently in that text. And there were no borders. It was exactly how she described it. We used Dr. Chancellor Williams' book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, to go into the Pan-African continental cultural mindset and how that worked on ancestral ties and family ties. And he described how that worked, and that it was a continental phenomenon before the advent of the colonization of the continent. So she's talking about things that are true. And there is something that needs to happen between the two because it's helping all of us. I'm going to go to the discussion we had earlier today, Jenna, with China. Minister Malcolm X used to talk about back in the day, they used to say you wouldn't have a Chinaman's chance if you know something going wrong in your life. You know, say, oh, you wouldn't have a Chinaman's chance. They had all these, you know, derogatory nicknames for Chinese, calling them chinks and all this kind of stuff. And today, China's in a place of power where you can't disrespect Chinese people in whatever country you at, because their government going to do something about it. When them Canadians arrested that Huawei rep, what did China do? They doubled up, arrested two Canadians, and was like, what's up? You got to let her out. You know what I mean? Like, they're not playing that. You gotta respect them now. They're not having it. And if the continent is able to come together and get to a place of power where they have some sort of nuclear defenses, not saying that they use it, but just have it as a protection mechanism against imperial domination, and they're able to use their resources for the betterment of the continent and its people, then that affects all African-descended people globally. Because other countries can't just mistreat Africa, because they're going to say, you know what, America, you get no cobalt. You know what? Y'all have no cell phones. You have no computers. You have no technology.
Well, that's saying
so they
that
would
they
have
don't...
to kowtow. But that's what controlling your resources would look like. And
there
Paul Kagame is trying to facilitate that along with a lot of other African leaders at this point. And it's a slow bubble, but I wish them the best in that endeavor. Go ahead. What you going to say?
Control your resources. Like you say, it's
absolutely
it's happening slowly. And them white people is calling for everybody in the world to come and stop it.
They are mad. They are straight up mad. And they're mad, especially with China. They're really trying to play a game of chess with China. And China doesn't play chess. Like Dave said, they play Go. They about controlling time and space. They don't care about the machinations of military conquest and political domination, which is nothing but soft warfare in the form of ideology and political stances. You know what I'm saying? They deal with controlling time and space. And they're like, this is our time to control stuff, and we're running it. And you can't do nothing about it because we got nuclear weapons too. And we got a bigger and better military and, you know, and all the other things that they come with. And they got the world behind them because a lot of countries that have turned against the U.S. are doing business with China. So, you know, it's major things that are happening, but there's a slow bubble with African people. And if we can really, really start working towards the things that some of our greatest ancestors asked us to do, which was to make connections globally with our people, does it mean that every one of us is going to get along? No. Do I believe that? Absolutely not, because it's not possible. Some of us are just too infected and infested with the system of white supremacy. Some of us are invested in the system of white supremacy. And that's just, and the VGQ, that's their response. You know, but the bottom line is everybody's not going to be able to be helped. And that's something I resolved myself to a very long time ago. Some of those people might be very close to me, might be people I love very dearly, family members. But, you know, if push comes to shove, sometimes you said it before, I can't drown trying to help you save you from drowning.
Hey,
I'm not gonna drown myself trying to save you. It's just not gonna happen. Go ahead.
I'm gonna just pass out some of these ideas that I'm gonna be towing around with in 2019, and for everybody who hears this, maybe they could entertain something similar. Me personally, I'm a diesel mechanic. Small engine mechanic is one of those things. We done played a few different videos here just to kind of give notice to what's on the rise in Africa that's available for us over here. You was just talking about you didn't mention it tonight, but what is that, Ghana with the
dual citizenship,
you know?
There's a couple other countries that are allowing for that, too. I think Cameroon's another one, and there's a few other ones that are doing it. And slowly but surely, more and more countries are actually doing that. Trying to make it easier for us. And again, it's about creating that.
Right.
That... Go ahead. My bad.
No worries. Just like you was stating, it's several more countries, but... dual citizenship. You was talking about getting businesses and stuff going. These are just a quick few ideas that come across my head. Maybe it could help somebody out there. Using myself as an example, I'm gonna make some of these phone calls and see what's all needed. I've been looking into different up and coming jobs over in Africa too. Been doing this for a while, but it's been an influx of people actually being able to sustain themselves for very little amount of money sometimes. Now, this only applies if you have skills that you could translate into money, whether that's software, considering we in the internet age, doing all of that stuff. Me, myself, diesel mechanics. Maybe there's a way that you could get something going with like a teaching where somebody could learn how to repair diesel machinery. Creating jobs. Just some things that I'm flirting with. Maybe you could insert whatever your skill is and look that up and see if it's possible for you to be able to create some jobs while also creating an opportunity for yourself, be your own contractor. I just wanted to add that in for that real quick. Just crossed my mind, wanted to add that. But
yeah,
go ahead on and take us in a break real quick, and we're going to just move right on through.
Okay, cool. You are now live with myself, Ross, and my partner, Jenna Kepra, on Black Talk Radio Network via Foundational Radio Network. On Real Life, the radio show. If you wish to call in and ask a question or make a comment, please give us a call at 704-802-5056. Again, that's 704-802-5056. And press ** if you wish to ask a question or make a comment.
My bad. You want to go ahead and get into this last video and we can
For sure.
Kind of tie this all in together.
Absolutely.
All right.
There's an exercise where we could say this. Rockstar energy drink. Wow, I just put that in history. See how quick history come up right there. Rockstar energy drink. Those who want to do the exercise, we're going to say rock star to ourselves without opening our mouths, without saying anything outside. We're going to say this to ourselves. We're going to say rock star to ourselves. Don't say it out loud at the count of three. One, two, three. Okay. Now, the question to ask, if you've said rock star in your mind, the question to ask is, what voice is that? What voice is that? What voice just spoke? You just said rock star without moving your mouth at all. On top of that, you on top of saying rock star, you heard yourself say rock star. How can you hear yourself say rock star and no vibration of sound has happened? See, this puts a different perspective on what sound actually is and what memory is. Memory's not in the brain, memory's in the soul. The only thing you take with you after this life is your memories or your knowledge, your experiences. That's the only thing you take. Unless you study Egypt culture, they believe you can take all their stuff with you and do the other side. Just as a side note. But if you said rock star in your mind or in your being is the true answer, is the true statement. In your being, what was that voice? What was the voice that spoke and then you heard yourself speaking? But these ears did not hear you say anything because your mouth didn't move. So the ears didn't hear it, the mouth did not move, but you spoke and you heard yourself speaking. If you close your eyes, you can see this better. If you close your eyes and put this image in another sight, if you close your eyes, you can still see this. What is the sight that can see your future? These two eyes don't see the future. These two eyes don't see the past. Yet, you can see your past and you can see your future. You can actually see your past. What is the sight that can see beyond time? Don't give it away. This is an ancient meditation. This is an ancient meditation that I am not the flesh. I am the energy, the consciousness, the being in the flesh. And this is proof. This is no faith. This is not religion. This is actual fact. You can speak without moving your mouth. You can hear without ears. You can see without eyes. So what happens when these eyes, this mouth, and this ear drops off into the grave? These other senses are all you're left with. Death is an illusion. Once you realize this, you live your life more courageously. Now, no one wants to die before their time, so you try to protect yourself. But know that this body is the limitation of you. It is not your zenith. It is not your ultimate. Your ultimate is that voice that just said rock star. That voice that just said rock star without nothing physical moving, that person is immortal. That person is not here with you. Let's go deeper. The body is in, what is it, three dimensions, right? Forward, back, right, left, up, down, and time. Fourth dimension. Three dimensions plus time. That's our physical reality. Front, back, right, left, up, down, that's 3D plus time. What happened to in and out? Look at the East, look at the English thought. Back, forth, right, left, up, down, no in and out. No in and out. What is in and out? Rock star. Rock star says, I exist without the body. So where is this other existence? Where is it? It's not here. It's not in three-dimensional space where you really are. The person that said this is in a whole different dimension. Just switch a little bit. Talk to yourself more. Affirm to yourself more. Don't move none of this. No, close this down and go within and say, I am the greatest dot, dot, dot ever. I have all my needs coming with speed. I am a being of love and light and knowledge. No weapon formed against me shall prosper. Whatever it is, have your affirmation on your tongue. Or, sorry, in your being. This is how the gods created this whole reality. The first humans, imagine. The first humans, they came from inner space. They came out. Study the Anunnakis. They came out of inner space. Not from up, outer space. Inner space. Rockstar. Before there was a body, there was this voice. Traveling in this voice's dimension. To get here to the earth. The inner voice created this outer extension of itself to be in this dimension. Once you realize that you are not just in this dimension, but you're also in another dimension, you now are free. Because whatever happens to you here in this dimension is not your only reality. See, this is how Jesus was able to get beaten and brutalized and hang on the cross. He wasn't here. He was the rock star. Inside, he went to the inner man. Do what you want with the body. I'm not here. Now, once you realize that level of consciousness, where you are officially, you identify yourself as the spirit, not the flesh. You are the inner voice, not the outer voice. Once you become the inner voice, now your outer voice has power. Now when you speak, it's not just a shell speaking. There's a being speaking through the shell. And this is where you heal all sickness in your body. This is where you command reality to work with you, and it works according to your consciousness. Why? Because it's not a shell that's speaking. There's a real being in the shell that is speaking. And when the real being speaks, all nature and the universe respond.
Man, hey, Ross, and I know when people hear this, they want to know where is he getting this information. So can you give a little drop on KRS-One, because we done we incorporate some of his thinking quite often.
Yeah, KRS is a very interesting dude. He's actually of Trinidadian descent, and he grew up in the Bronx with his brothers, ICU and Kenny Parker. And he was homeless. He left home at around 12, 13 years old. purposefully, like after he was an adventurous child, and he used to like to just go around the city. He was getting into graffiti and tagging and all this other stuff. And him and his mom had gotten into a disagreement about some of the decisions he was making at a young age. And as the eldest brother, he was picked up and broke out. So he ended up in a homeless shelter, and he would spend all his time basically going to the libraries around New York City and reading their books and studying. And also he came in contact with the Hare Krishnas, which is where he got the name Chris or KRS-One from. It's from Hare Krishna. And of course, Krishna means black, and Krishna is the deity of Hinduism, one of the main deities of Hinduism. So that was the name that he had adopted as his moniker. While he was homeless, he also met his partner, Scott LaRock, who was actually a counselor in one of the homeless shelters that he was staying in. And that's how they ended up clicking up, and eventually ended up getting their record deal. And of course, Criminal Minded was released, and you know, the rest was history. By the time the second album was about to be released, Scott LaRock was murdered, and that basically facilitated a rapid growth in the development of KRS's consciousness towards trying to stop violence, because he really came from a background of running drugs. He had gotten caught with a Wonder Bread truck full of marijuana one time, trafficking, wilding out, I think on the Cross Brooks Expressway as a very, very young man. So he put in a lot of that kind of work on the street, you know, just doing wild things and getting into trouble and stuff. And after Scott was killed, basically that really, I think they were always going in that direction, because he was always intelligent, even though he did spit some gangsterisms in his rap. He had a rapid transition in that direction, and of course went into the Stop the Violence movement and everything else. So basically that's the basic history of KRS-One. Now, he also studied all kinds of different traditions. One of them was the Rastafarian tradition. He used to actually deal with a lot of dreads and Rastas when he was on the street. And when he was hustling marijuana, it was connections with Rastas that he had and all of that kind of stuff. And ultimately, he incorporates a lot of those teachings and philosophies into his way of life. And he's also studied Kemet very, very heavily, and the spiritual system of Kemet as well, which is where you're hearing the quantum physics in his discussion and the whole concept of living beyond the body in that kind of a detail is more of a comedic thing. It ties into the comedic proverb that's found in the Metuneta that I discussed before, which compares God to an ocean of consciousness, and man is basically considered individual drops out of the ocean of the Creator's consciousness, which gives us the same powers as the deity. Because we're just on a smaller scale. So in other words, it's like if you take a drop of water out of the ocean, it doesn't change the fact that it's still water. It has the same properties and qualities of water, just on a smaller scale. And that's the comparison between the Creator as consciousness, living consciousness, and us as the offspring of that consciousness and the highest expression of that consciousness as far as the living things on the planet Earth. That's pretty much what he's building on it and discussing is who is that. And that is basically dealing with the concept of indivisible duality. And that just speaks to the fact that you have one part of your being that is a temporary being, that being itself has human wants, likes, dislikes, attractions and things that it doesn't want to be around. It might have things that are triggers for it. It's the human aspect of you, or the animus part of you. And then you have the immortal part of you, the self. And the self doesn't function like the personality. It doesn't have wants or needs, and it doesn't have likes or dislikes. It just is. And that's the aspect of yourself you share with the Creator. In order for you to function as a human organism in the flesh and have a proper existence for the Creator to express itself through you as a living thing, then we have a social system which makes us social beings. So we are around mirror images of ourselves all the time. We're in a system and society that teaches us not to see other Black people as mirror images of ourselves, but to see the people who oppress us as the God. So therein lies the problem and the complex with a lot of us understanding that sort of metaphysical discussion and the discussion of the true essence of the abilities of human beings in reference to the fact that we are children of the Creator in the truest sense of the word. So, you know, I don't know if that answered your question or...
Man, but, it did and so much more. Okay. He was speaking directly.
Okay, cool.
He was speaking directly to what I was... one of the ideas I'd like everybody to kick around in their head as far as what do you specialize in for whatever reason, and see how you can turn that into some kind of a lucrative contract for you while also helping somebody in the process. And it may be even easier than you think, but you have to believe that you could make those type of moves first and foremost. But I know you wanted to play those three videos. I would like to know, what is the how are you going to tie those three together?
Okay, how I tie them together is this. I think that we really need to develop a codified way of dealing with each other when we come in contact with each other. We have to have a code that's based on Black self-respect, a code that says that we're not going to be judgmental and adversarial towards other Black people. Now, it doesn't mean that you're going to get along with all Black people. It doesn't mean that other Black people might not be disdainful towards you, because we have a lot of sick people in the world, myself included. I don't separate myself from that, because we're all infected and infected with white supremacy in some form or fashion. But the truth is, if we make a conscious effort
real quick,
go ahead.
To speak to your point real quick, that exact thing happened to me. Just like we always talk about, just being polite, you know, passing some good energy along. I met a young lady, an educator actually, and just the fact that I was wanting to help them with their bags, they was having a little bit of trouble. I helped them with their bags. They appreciated it. Seeing them the next day, because I was at a hotel, and she started speaking to me. I asked her, I didn't ask her, but I told her, I said, my apologies for if I scared you, because we have a tendency to do that, or at least feel that way. And you know, this young lady offered to pay for my stay. So it was just that simple forward generosity that we need to start doing together.
Yeah. And the thing is that we used to be like that all the time. Even in America, when you go back to like the Green Book and how Black people could go to bed and breakfasts at other Black people's homes and not worry about racial terrorism while traveling throughout the United States. And these were strangers. They didn't know these people. They weren't buddies. And they still understood the system was as such, that they needed to have that kind of trust with each other throughout the country in order to protect the lives of other Black people. That's a great example of that. To me, that kind of is a mirror image of the story that I discussed that Dr. Ben talked about, when he talked about, you know, that spot in Gondar where you had all these different ethnic groups coming to this. Basically, it's like a rudimentary store to get goods that they needed to take back to their respective tribes, and nobody stole. So even when the owner of the location wasn't there, he could leave a bowl and people would take what they need and leave whatever payment it was in the bowl, and nobody ever stole, and everybody, you know, did everything in an upright way. To me, like when you look at the Green Book thing, that's a mirror image of that over here. They understood that there was no room for people to be, you know, being criminals and whatnot, when you got white people literally trying to kill you just for traveling to see a relative in another part of the country, and you need to pull over because you've been driving for like half a day and you're exhausted, and there's nowhere for you to pull over where you might not get your head blown off or hung from a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an innate understanding that, yeah, we can't practice non-justice with each other. We need to be able to trust each other emphatically and without question. Why can't we get back to that, where you could stop and ask to help a sister and she not look at you with those eyes like, yo, is he going to friggin' assault me or threaten me? You know what I mean? Like that, like we got work to do. Like this, like we should really, really be in a state that's more conducive to being as helpful as possible and understanding, so that even when you encounter a Black person who may not be the most pleasant person to come in contact with, you have a high level of understanding that we're all being brutalized and you don't know what might have just happened to that person before you encountered them.
Right.
So instead of taking it personally, you say, you know what? Yeah, this person's talking to me real foul and whatnot, but I'm not going to let my ego rule, and I'm not going to assault them, or I'm not going to, you know, badger them back or facilitate an argument. I'm just going to, you know, minimize contact and minimize conflict and back off. Whatever it takes to not get into a conflict with another Black person, but just a high level of understanding of the fact that some of us don't take and deal with suffering in a good way. And a lot of us are mentally ill. So when you put suffering and mental illness together, you got a powder keg for all kinds of disasters. And that's really what it is. And there's an essay that I wrote, weirdly enough, a number of years ago about education, and the sister Pam had posted it on her site. I wish that she rest in power. She was one of the women that was really trying to do the struggle and uphold Dr. Wilson's values and ways and thoughts and ideas about the system of white supremacy and helping other Black people. So she really is a person of respect for me. And she liked the essay that much that she honored me by putting it on her site. But there's an African proverb that I was taught by my master teacher and spiritual father, who's now deceased, when I went through the initiatic process. And I wanted to speak about it because to me, this is a great example of the psychology, the psychological mindset and indoctrination we need to let go of as African descendant people, as Scotty always says, and peace to you, Scotty, too. So I just want to read it real quick. It's not that long, but I think it's quite profound. So it's the story of the lion and the boars. The story begins with a lion cub lost and wandering, who suddenly finds himself surrounded by wild boars. Boars, the natural prey of the lion, wondered what to do about the cub suddenly in their midst. They knew with him being a cub, he was going to a supreme hunter of their kind. The vegetarian boars couldn't eat him as the lion would do to them. They thought about beating him up, but quickly dashed the idea for fear of retaliation from the lion. Suddenly, the leader of the boars had an idea. He said, quote, "This cub is young and innocent. It knows nothing and is totally helpless. Let's take him and raise him into thinking he is one of us." The boars gave it some thought and agreed it was a good idea, a good plan. So they did just that. The plan worked so well that the cub grew into an adult lion who ate grass like the wild boars that raised him. He was the best warning system they had while grazing, acting as a sentinel or lookout. Anytime he saw lions hunting, he would scream, "Oh, my brothers, oh, my sisters, the wicked, bad, evil killers are coming." Then he and the boars would run for cover as quickly as possible, saving them from being hunted down. It worked like a charm. The boars would occasionally discuss the success of their plan in secret. "How easy it is to raise someone into believing they are you," the leader said. "What you do is transfer your identity onto him, your concerns and your fears. He will feel your concerns and fears, and he will protect you. This is what man did to dogs. They transferred their fears and concerns onto the dog. They turned dogs from their hunters and competitors to their companions and protectors, domesticating them. The importance of the dog in ancient human survival is evident by his title, man's best friend." One day, the pride of lions surprised the herd of wild boars. As everyone scattered, the kidnapped lion ran with the boars to safety. The hunting lions naturally assumed it was one of their own trying to catch a boar for the prize. As the boars reached the hiding place, they saw the lion they had raised, but they had gotten scared and locked him out. In all the confusion, the boars did not know if he was a real lion or the one they subdued. The lion begged them to let him in. They took no chances. Soon, he found himself cornered. As the lions approached, he shook with unimaginable terror. He began to plead, "Oh, you bad, wicked, evil lions, please don't eat me." The other lions were shocked, asking, "Is he joking?" When the young lion began shivering in fear, they realized he was serious. The leader of the lion said, "Look at us and look at you. I'd say the only difference is in your mind." Looking at the sniveling boars still quivering in their hole, the elder lion said with disgust, "The boars, the ones you thought were your people, didn't they turn on you? Didn't they lock you out?" The story ends with the young lion pondering his predicament. That is the predicament of Black people globally. We see that we have been so raised and acculturated into taking on the fears, thoughts, ideas, and the system of the enemy that we have learned to see each other with the disdain of the enemy, and we have been trained to see the enemy as our family. And every time we do that, they lock us out. They let you know you're a nigger. How many more hundreds of years will it take for us to learn that we need to take a different approach to our survival? The same approach that white people take to their survival is the approach that we need to take. Whenever there's a squabble amongst Black people and a non-Black person comes around, you put that squabble to the side immediately and you deal with the other person who is non-Black in your midst, get them out of your midst, and then you can go back to doing whatever you do in private. You never go out in public and embarrass another Black person. You do not malign or speak negatively about another Black person to anyone, but most especially another white person. Why is it hard to adopt those codes? That is a code I've been living for a long time.
Man,
it's something I taught to my son. It's something I pass on to as many people as possible. Because if I can help at least one person shift in their understanding of the world we live in and what the things that we can personally do in our daily life to try and make things better for all of us, then I feel like I'm accomplishing something. And again, I never separate myself when I analyze the self-destructive psyche of African people. I am right in the midst of that. I always say myself included because I am included. I work at it every day. And that's the only way to really make it a permanent change is to be mindful. And mindful just means to be aware at all times of everything you do, even the things you think, as those thoughts are coming to you. And you really seek to gain a semblance of control over your thought patterns and processes and the way that you function on such an intimate level with yourself that it starts to show in the levels of control and respect you have with other people because you respect yourself first that way. That's what I had to learn to do, was to respect myself on the highest level possible. And once I was able to do that, I can mirror that in the way that I treat and respect other people. That's why even when I had difficulties with other Black people, and I've had Black people try to disrespect me, and I'm a person who's prone to handling things in a very, very volatile way. And I've been able to make the right decision of not embarrassing myself or making our people look bad through my personal action or interaction with another Black person. Do some Black people get me mad enough to go in that bag? Absolutely. But if I indulge that, I'd be in jail all the time. Because there's always a person who looked like you that's going to be able to push your buttons. And if anyone can get you angry to that point, then they control you. That's what I had to learn. If someone can get you angry to the point where you jeopardize your actual freedom, and we're not free, but freedom in the sense of being a prisoner that's able to live outside the walls of an actual prison complex, then that person is controlling you, and you're allowing them to control your behavior. And that is sheer stupidity from a standpoint of you making conscientious decisions that are most optimal for you to live a decent, positive life outside of the prison industrial complex. I made a long time a vow to not let another person control me. If I have to get violent with you, it's going to be because it is something that is the only other option for me in that situation. And, you know, it would take a very big thing to make me have to do that to anyone at this point. But don't think I'm not capable of it either. Because you might be surprised on the wrong day. But I'm just saying in general that I have a high level of self-control. And I learned that because I was a guy with a very low level of self-control. And it was all about what the things Joy DeBree talked about. Not being seen, being invisible, not being respected. And I had to realize that there's different ways of going about getting respect. And it doesn't always have to take putting hands on someone to get respected. sometimes you can get respect just by dealing with things in the way in which people don't expect you to deal with them. And you really sparing the other person, not yourself. Because if you choose to go there, it's that person that's going to suffer really bad. And you might suffer after the fact. But if you're really a person who has gotten into that stuff before, you'll be willing to suffer whatever comes to you after that. But that person's going to feel your wrath, and it's not going to be good for them. And, you know, some people are like that. I'm one of those people. So for me, a high level of self-control, that is what my spiritual practice gave me, a high level of the ability to analyze the deity in someone else. Because that's what you're looking at, is expressions of the Creator. You yourself are, me, myself, am an expression of the Creator, and as is everyone else that looks like me. And every other living thing, for that matter. These are the things our ancestors understood. They didn't just chop down trees. They would actually cry, have ceremonies for the tree, and thank it for giving its life in order for them to be able to utilize it for whatever they needed it for. That's a respect for the deity and another living thing. We've lost all of that. And that's why we can look at each other and just outright do the most heinous things to each other and not blink twice about it. And yet when the white man come around, we kowtow, and you can have a 9mm in your waist. Yes, sir. You be nice, you be patient, kind, all of that. And when a black man come around, you ready to pull a hammer on them.
Man.
We've lost that. We've lost that. We have to reconnect with that. And that is the antithesis to the culture and system that we live and dwell in today. And that's one of the most important things about what we can gain from our past as an African people. The Queen of the Congo talked about that. We are a loving people. We are a caring people. We are a nurturing people. That is our actual historical reference for hundreds of thousands of years. It is in our recent history that all of this volatility and negativity and self-destruction has come into play. But it is the most important part of our history, because it can set the precedent for our sheer destruction, or the precedent for a renaissance and the ability for us to rise to the occasion and become the parent people that we are, like the Queen of the Congo said so eloquently earlier.
Okay.
Let's do that. Go ahead, brother.
Yeah, because we're going to, whoa, my apologies. We're going to wrap it up a little, we're going to wrap it on up. I'm going to give what my reason for following through with playing those in the exact order to the Queen King had made a lot of points as far as growing up not knowing the restraint on the information that's being placed on Africa. The sentiment she gave about the African people wanting us back, because that's one of the claims that we hear a lot. They ain't never come and get us. It was even on on that Eddie Griffin thing I put up in BTR community.
Yes, that's why I clicked like on it, because I remembered it when I heard it. I was like, yeah. And it's, but go ahead. Let me not interrupt your train of thought.
But she was admitting to all of this and telling all of us that we are better together. And the angel video was basically just adding on to that, explaining why we are better as one, which, like Brother Scotty says, and I don't think you can get more accurate than what he says, and that is that we'll never truly be one, you know, like me and him both say on several occasions, we can't even get along with each other. But like you was just stating, and we done said this over and over and over throughout the year, plus that we should be able to come to a consensus to where this is how we're going to operate when we're in front of white people. Outside of that, we have to, you know, we'll take care of whatever we need to take care of after we get this problem situated. Going back to KRS-One, I thought with the two of them going back and forth just to be able to manifest it, like he was saying, through that being able to speak what you want to happen into existence, that's what's needed to make what both of those previous videos come to life.
Yep.
So with that being said, We appreciate y'all spending a little bit of your Christmas Eve. And for those of you who don't celebrate Christmas, all of the holidays that you practice, or at least tell people that you practice, and those of you who just don't, enjoy your time with your family. Make sure everybody know you love them, and you don't have to leave them no note, or they have to tell you after you're gone. And we'll see you next year. It won't be a show next week. So, Brother Rise, if you could take us out, and we love the way we have pushed the type of propaganda that we believe our listeners need to know about. I think it has been wonderful this past year with all the troubles and all the just every event that happened throughout this time. I have grown, and I have loved the fact that I adopted still learning from Dr. Fuller, because it's never more true than right now. Peace.
I agree. Thanks for that one. That was a great ending. We greatly appreciate everyone spending their December 24th Christmas Eve with us. Thanks to everyone for the input, Sister Kia, Brother Otis, all the other calls and listeners who may not have called in but were listening or are listening to the program. We greatly appreciate you, those who will listen to the podcast later. Please stay safe. Stay out of the hands of slave catchers. They have a lot of checkpoints up right now because a lot of people drink and drive around this time of the year. So please do not drive while intoxicated. Do not walk while intoxicated, because anything can happen, and you don't want to potentially put your life in danger during this time, because it'll make it even more traumatic for your family if they have to deal with something like that during a time that's supposed to be about family. So please stay safe. We'll see you after the new year. We won't be on next week, like Jenna said. And everyone have a happy new year. I actually celebrate my new year September 11th every year, but you know, I have to celebrate the Gregorian new year because that's the system that I'm in. So I keep track of both, but you know, wish everyone the best. Stay safe, stay sober, and sobriety will be best. And we're going to get into the prayer right now and close out the show for this evening. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. Like Gus says, it has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible, and let's end the prison industrial complex and human trafficking as well. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Thanks again for being with us this evening. Peace and love to those who celebrate. Merry Christmas. And we'll see you again after the new year. Peace and love. Stay safe. One.
Peace and love. Everybody be easy and be safe. Peace.